You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. I have with me today my good friend and conservative journalist, Cassie Dillon, who you may remember from our somewhat short-lived but very epic podcasting days where we co-hosted a show. For those of you who are new, I'm glad to introduce you to Cassie. Cassie, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on, even though, you know, hot takes was a fun time, Brad. That was our
podcast. Yeah, I know. But here's the fun part, though. At the end of the show, I do ask everybody for their hot food take, and I know that you've got plenty of them.
Oh, gosh.
Pressure. We've already had somebody give their hot take about Hawaiian pizza, and I know that's part of your niche, but maybe you'll have to think of something other than that, as divisive as it may be. But anyway.
I don't forget it.
All right, anyway. All right, you got it? Good.
Yep.
Anyway, the issue I brought you on to discuss was something, you know, everything in the news is so stressful right now. I thought we would just discuss something light and fluffy and that people would just can relax and enjoy. Abortion. No, I kid. But you are very prominent for being a young conservative woman who is very pro-life. And so I think it's interesting to talk about this because this is one thing where I don't think conservatives have moved, right? I mean, conservatives have moved a lot on some social issues like gay rights, for example, but being pro-life is still a core tenet of what it means to be a conservative. So maybe just to start, what does it mean to you to be pro-life?
Well, being pro-life means that you believe abortion is wrong and that you believe that a baby becomes a baby at conception, that you cannot get rid of this baby that's in a womb. So I like to think that I'm a little bit different than most pro-lifers because of my background. I come from a very liberal state, a family that was very broken. So I didn't grow up being pro-life at all. My mother's had abortions, but we'll talk a little bit about my family too, because it is why I'm pro-life, but not because the reason you would think. But also, I wasn't always pro-life. I wasn't pro-life until my first year of college when I started thinking about the issue. You know, when you're growing up in a poor area like I did, and you hear about teen pregnancy, my best friend got pregnant when she was 14 years old. We were best friends growing up, and at 14 years old, she had her baby. You know, that's in middle school. And so when you hear those things growing up, you're like, oh, well, you should have had an abortion. Like, that's just something that's very common. Why would you have a baby if you're that young? You know, so it's just something that's expected when you grow up in areas like that. And it's a lot because of the messaging from the abortion lobby. So I do come from a little bit different of a background, and my background's not religious. I'm pro-life because of science, not because of religion.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, too, because we're both from Massachusetts, right? So basically, most people I knew were always pro-choice, and that was kind of the default assumption. And there was always this kind of caricature of pro-life as a religious thing. It must be based on your Christianity, and you just want to make your Christianity the law. And I'm also not religious and didn't grow up very religious, just a little bit, but not very much so. And I just think it's a question of, like you said, science, and also a question of morality. And so I don't think there's anything necessary about being pro-life that requires you to be religious. But how do you flesh that out?
So I flesh it out by solely looking at the science of it. I do believe in the next 50 to 100 years that they'll be able to take babies out of the womb and put them in incubators and have them grow up that way. I think if the science is there, things are going to change. Look, from 1973, Roe v. Wade, science has, you know, grown so much even from then. We have babies being born at earlier times than ever before and living to maturity, even though they're extremely pre-born or premature. So science is catching up. So what are these pro-choicers going to do when it's no longer necessary to get rid of the baby because the baby can live in an incubator? What are they going to do? They're going to say, oh, well, you know, it's still my baby, so I want to kill it, even before they say, well, it's not a baby. Well, we can prove it's a baby. We can watch it develop. So I think science is really going to hurt the pro-choice movement in the future because there are so many advances being made. But primarily, I'm pro-life in the terms of science because I think that this is a child with its own unique DNA, and it deserves to live. It has the potential to become a human being that is operating by itself without assistance. Why cut it off and kill it when there are so many other options of what to do with that child? And I know that's such a long-winded response, but there's so many different facets of the pro-life movement. and different beliefs and different explanations. There are countless books about how to respond to pro-choice arguments, but primarily for me, it's a science thing. I respect people that invoke religion. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you're going to win over people who aren't religious, you need to come with the science aspect for sure.
Right. I agree with that. And I actually think the political pro-life movement does a good job of not making it about Bible verse. Like, of course, your religion, you're entitled to that. But if you want to convince voters, you have to make it kind of an a-religious or secular argument. And part of that means we're responding to the notion that it's about women's bodily autonomy. And I to some extent, I can't imagine what it would be like to be a woman and be pregnant and not have wanted to be, and to have to carry a baby to term. Now, I don't think that justifies, like you said, taking another human life, but it seems like such a really difficult thing for a woman to go through. And I think that's why people gravitate to it as an issue of women's bodily autonomy. Why is it that you think that argument is wrong?
Well, I think that it can be scary to be pregnant, especially if it's unplanned. That's a scary thing. These women are going through something that's going to change your life forever. Whether you keep the baby or get rid of the baby, your life is changed. So I think that, you know, killing the baby or getting rid of the baby, if you want to use less harsh terms, it's not going to fix the underlying problem of how you're going to feel about that. You know, women after abortion, they really do. A lot of women do regret their abortions and they deal with this trauma. People in my life who have had abortions still have issues getting over that. They have counseling retreats for women who've had abortions. You know, it's traumatic. And especially for the exceptions, the rape and incest, which I don't believe abortion's okay in those cases either. Those situations, you know, especially in rape, a woman has gone through trauma and you're going to inflict violence on an entity or a person who didn't commit violence or be involved in the violence because the father or the guy raped her. So what I'm trying to say is you're trying to correct an act of violence with another act of violence, and that's not going to help the woman heal. For instance, my grandmother conceived my mom in rape. My mom was conceived in rape. My mom, quote unquote, rape baby, they call her. No, my mom is a human being who unfortunately was conceived in rape, and my grandmother chose to keep her. And that's not because sometimes when I tell this story, they say, well, the laws in the time were, no, I'm from Massachusetts, like very liberal place. They had abortion. My grandmother kept my mom because she thought it was a unique human life. And I respect my grandmother for that. And if she didn't do that, I wouldn't be here. So I just think it's so wrong that the abortion lobby is constantly telling women the solution to their problem is to kill their baby. That's not the solution to their problem. The solution is healing and finding a way that does not harm another individual.
So this is an interesting, I think, path to go down, because one of the most common things I'll hear from pro-choice people is this idea that babies shouldn't be born into the world if they're not going to go to a loving family, if they're going to be born into poverty, or they're going to be in a broken home, or all sorts of things like this. And in one sense, I think it is compelling, right? Obviously, everyone's bothered by the idea of children being abused or impoverished or struggling. But then I often tend to think to myself, well, if I was behind a veil of ignorance and I didn't know, right, I was going to be born into the world, and my choice was either to be not born at all or to be born into difficult circumstances that people do rise out of, I would definitely choose the latter. So I've never really been convinced by that, but it's a really common, I think, belief that pro-choice people hold. How do you grapple with that argument?
It's the most elitist and disgusting argument that I hear from the pro-choice movement. If it's true, then I don't deserve to be alive because I grew up in poverty. I grew up in very horrible circumstances. We were on the verge of homelessness often. I was homeless at one point when I was very young. So if that were true, then I don't deserve to be alive right now. And I mean, if they want to look at me in my face and tell me that I don't deserve to be alive, I really don't think they would do that if I prompted them to. So I think that's a disgusting argument. The American dream is about people rising up out of their circumstances. This has been the case for centuries. Like, people can rise from those horrible circumstances. So saying that you don't deserve a shot to rise is ridiculous. I know there's a lot of bad homes out there, but there's a lot of good homes and a lot of homes willing to take in kids from bad homes. Our foster care system obviously isn't the best. And that's, I mean, our foster care system is primarily trying to reunite people with their parents, even if their parents are terrible. but there are a lot of people out there willing to help. And I wasn't really raised by my parents. My dad was not in the picture. My mom had a lot of mental health issues and drug issues going on. So I was primarily raised by my sister and then what I call the village. So, you know, my friends' parents, my teachers, my soccer coach, that kind of thing. So just to say that is just so ignorant and so elitist. And I hate it. That's the number one argument that pisses me off.
Well, I can certainly see why it would bother you with where you come from and your story, which I think is indicative of the fact that people can rise up from those circumstances. And nobody is, people certainly have different levels of opportunity, but nobody is doomed just by being born into their circumstance in America. And that's one of the great things about this country. But I guess all of this kind of starts from the premise that a fetus, or is how it would be perceived, is a human life. And I believe that, and obviously you believe that, but a lot of people don't. And so how do you kind of prove to someone that it is? Because other people unfortunately do just believe that aborting a fetus is like removing a tumor or a clump of skin cells or something like that. So you talked about the science earlier. What is it? What are the specific things that you offer to rebut that belief?
So for me, it's conception. When a new entity is formed from two other entities, it has its own DNA. But a lot of people they have like a spectrum, and they're like, you know, maybe I kind of feel like today a fetus is a fetus at 8 weeks when it has a heartbeat. Or maybe it's when the second trimester begins. Or maybe it's right before it's born. You know, going through the vaginal canal just makes you a human. It's such a powerful thing that the second you go through it, you're now a human. It's like a portal. That's crazy to me. And you see people saying that third trimester abortions are okay right into the up to birth, the day before birth, it's totally okay to abort your child. That's crazy. That's literally saying that a vaginal canal is this portal of morality that you get to go through it and then you can live, which is crazy. Some people say the heartbeat, 8 weeks. Okay, fair. I get that argument. But if your heart stops beating in the hospital, are you no longer a human? If they can bring you back, you just stop being a human at that second. So there's like this spectrum that people don't really know where to place it. They don't know where to say, okay, human life begins here. The most consistent one is conception. There's a new entity. It's a human being, conception. If you do the heartbeat, there's fallacies. And if you do right before birth, then you're kind of crazy. And we actually saw Tulsi Gabbard, which I know you're in love with her.
I love her.
She introduced a bill to protect children that abortion survivors were born alive. That it happens. There are, and I've met them, there are people who are born alive during an abortion. And she just simply said, you need to give them medical care. Well, apparently some people also believe that you're a human, whether your parents want you or not. So, you know, outside the womb can survive. Too bad your mom doesn't want you. They're going to leave you there and give you comfort care and just put you over there and just wait for you to die when they could save you. They show this in the movie Gosnell. They talk about it quite a bit. So it's just, people are just inconsistent, but for me, it is conception.
And to some people that they look at that and they basically say, well, that's just a cell, right? It's a fertilized zygote. Why is that when it's still so early on, why is it still a person?
It's a person because it has its own unique DNA and it's even can have its own blood type early on. So, you know, it's something different than the parents. And if you just left it there, it would completely be able to live on its own. So I think just denying it because it's small is crazy to me. It's going to become a human. If somebody is on life support and they're not able to live on their own, should we just pull the plug? Oh, it's not a human anymore. They need the life support. No, it's crazy. Just let it develop. And if you don't want it, put it up for adoption. I understand that labor is intensive, but you should have made the right choices earlier on and used protection.
Well, you said it, not me. But that last statement there is, so you did touch on the rape and sexual assault exception, but kind of assuming that those cases aside.
Then, by the way, they're like 0.01% of abortions.
Right. They are a very small number of cases. But to set those aside for a moment, just talk about the 99%, right? In all of those cases, I mean, women do have agency, right? They didn't end up pregnant by accident or by accident, but they did choose to engage in unprotected sex, and that's how you get pregnant, and people do know that. So to some extent, I can see where you're coming from, where it's like an abortion is almost kind of bailing out of the consequences of your decision. And I understand those consequences bearing a child for 9 months and birth and all of that, it sounds like it's quite the ordeal that I'll never have to go through. But they are the consequences of your own decision in those 99%, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And getting pregnant is not as easy as people think. There are only a few days a month that women are actually fertile. Yeah, there's, you know, the small percentage, but one thing that a lot of women are using now is natural family planning. So they have phone apps. And I don't know if you know anything about this, Brad, being guy and gay, but
yeah, this is not my area.
And you take your temperature and you put in what day you menstruated, and it shows you which days of the month you're actually fertile. And it's not the majority of the days of the month at all. And a lot of people use that as a form of birth control, so they don't have to take a pill. But there are other ways to protect. Now, the pro-life movement is very against birth control. I'm not.
Wow. We have to talk about that, because that is something that has always struck me as self-defeating. I mean, I understand some people have religious beliefs, but the simplest way to reduce abortion is to reduce unwanted pregnancies. So I feel like if you're pro-life, you should be handing out birth control prescriptions and condoms like they're candy on Halloween.
Well, let me explain the hormone stuff. So first, condoms, they're very against condoms. This is primarily a religious argument and an argument of, you know, just sexual immorality. But I'm not part of that. Okay, when it comes to hormonal birth control, they have a valid argument. They really do. I don't think that we should stop giving hormonal birth control. I think it does help reduce abortion, but they do have a valid argument that you're putting these hormones into your body. There's many studies saying they can cause cancer. There's many studies saying, you know, blood clots. Some of my really good friends get blood clots from it. You can really get injured from that. It changes your mood. It can give you acne. It can get rid of acne. It can make you gain weight. It can make you lose weight. So there's a lot of issues with the hormone situation when it comes to, you know, contraceptives. I mean, there are other alternatives. I really don't know how much of this you know, but there's also
I doubt
they have, you know, a copper IUD that you can put in, and that is non-hormonal and that can also work. But the primary argument for especially the pill and the shot is the hormone aspect. It can hurt women. And then there's also the aspect where they'll argue, well, you know, the girls are putting this into their body while the guys get to be irresponsible. How is that fair? And that's a fair argument to me too, but I do think that we should not ban hormonal birth control because it does reduce abortion. But I do see the arguments for why it'll be bad. So if women do take it, I think they need to recognize the risks with it. And I don't think doctors are really giving them all the risks as much as they should.
Yeah, I think that's a fair concern. And I certainly, this is not my terrain, but I would say that to me, the birth control, that seems like something that should 100% be the woman's choice. Right, because they're not hurting another person. So even if there are risks involved, if they're informed of those risks and choose to do it anyway, that seems to me like totally their right and their liberty.
That's 100% my stance.
Yeah, and I guess one other thing that I'll say, some of the socially conservative pro-life movement, they do get into these things like opposing birth control. And I have no issue if they want to personally oppose birth control, if that's their faith, if that's what they want to live in their life. I know lots of people like that. That's all good. Imposing that through government, though, I think is not only self-defeating in terms of reducing abortion, but it's also it's wrong. It's right. It's imposing your morality on others through the state.
Well, I haven't seen many pro-lifers pushing against birth control in the form of legal action. I see a lot of articles saying, you know, your daughter shouldn't take this, it's dangerous. I've seen that, but I haven't seen a lot of legal action. The fight that they're on right now is the pill. What's it called? When you take the day after pill? No. Well, that's part of it too. That's also because of hormones and also because it can abort a fetus. It can, well, not a fetus yet, but it can eject a fertilized egg from your uterus. So they're saying that you just killed it from that. There's a slight risk of that from Plan B, but it's not the majority of the cases. However, they're more worried about oral abortions. So you don't take the pill. They give you an abortion pill and you take it at home. The issue right now, because of that, is with COVID, they're now giving you the abortion pill over the phone instead of doing it in the office. You know, you go into the abortionist, then you take the pill, whatever. The problem, the major problem with that is the abortion pill is not, you take a pill and it's gone. Women go through intense pain. They go through cramping. The movie Unplanned shows what it can look like. You can be on the floor of your bathroom for hours in pain. And women have died from taking the abortion pill. And now that they're giving it out without consulting a doctor in person is really dangerous. So that's the main thing that the abortion or the pro-life movement is fighting back against right now. And mainly because of COVID.
So that's an interesting one. Slightly related but different. What is your stance on, I have a friend, Tiana Lowe, who strongly believes that she's pro-life, but she also believes that birth control pills should be sold over the counter, not abortion pills, but like birth control. She doesn't think you should need a prescription. She says you should just be able to talk to a pharmacist and purchase it. And that's something I think some young women who are pro-life or are right of center do believe. And there's actually been bills in Congress to enact that. What do you think of that?
I disagree with that. I think that it could be dangerous. And I think that women usually need to get your blood pressure because they can cause blood clots, and it happens a lot more than you think. And also girls constantly change their birth controls. You know, if it's making you eat less or it's making you more grumpy or it's giving you acne, you consult with your doctor and they give you a new birth control. There's not just birth control. There's so many different kinds. You can get low estrogen. You can add iron into your birth control if you're anemic. You know, there's so many different types of birth control. So I really do think that having a doctor is good. And in California, you can actually purchase your birth control online and talk to a doctor on webcam and they'll send it to you. But I really do think that you need a doctor because things can go wrong and you need to know.
So one thing that I think is interesting is the question of Roe v. Wade, and with it as our existing framework, it pretty clearly protects a constitutional right to abortion that they found in the text. What do you think the pro-life movement are? The idea of repealing Roe v. Wade is not something that will happen in the short term, right? Not this year, not next year. In the meantime, what is the pro-life movement's kind of priorities?
I wouldn't be so sure about that. We still have the control of the Supreme Court. And even RBG has said that Roe v. Wade is a very weak decision. And it's not because she thinks abortion should be banned. It's because it really is a weak legal position. I'm not an expert on it, but I do know it goes more after privacy of the person. And how private is that? I mean, I'm not an expert on it, but Lila Rose of Live Action really has a great video actually tracing the history of it and talking about why it is a weak legal position. And a lot of liberal jurists will say this too, that it's just weak. It was poorly written. It gives you a test of when, you know, when it's okay to abort. So, and with science catching up, is it still okay? So it's very weak. But right now the pro-life movement, you know, they had 4 years of growth. They had, you know, they banned giving foreign aid for abortion and they had a lot of wins. Now it's going to go back to trying to resist and doing things on the state level. They're not going to have any federal help at all.
What do you think will happen under the Biden-Harris administration in terms of abortion-related policies?
Well, I think we're going to see they're going to allow the abortion pill to be, you know, allowed in all 50 states. I think they're going to try pushing that federally. They're going to give more funding to Planned Parenthood and funding. They're going to get rid of the Hyde Amendment. They're going to give more funding to abortion internationally. They're just going to make it easier to get an abortion. And I really do think that the abortion pill, they'll probably legalize in all 50 states without having to see a doctor.
And to what extent do you think there will be action on the conservative side of the spectrum in terms of challenging these things in court or even just culturally? Because one thing that's been interesting is that abortion rates have gone down significantly over time since Roe v. Wade. And that's not because of the tons of laws changing as much as it is socially and culturally and economically things changing. So if the pro-life movement is locked out of the government, at least at the federal level, for the next 2 years in terms of pursuing reforms, where do they go instead? Do they focus culturally? Do they focus state and local? Or what do you think the most fertile ground for advancing the cause is?
So the pro-life movement's really good on the state level. I mean, the Republicans still have the state legislatures, and there's a lot of pro-life state legislators. So primarily what they're doing is they are trying to push the heartbeat bills, which, you know, get challenged in court, but they're still trying to push them. They're hoping that it goes to the Supreme Court and they get a favorable ruling or one in the future. They haven't gotten any yet. But, you know, also in Texas, they're starting this thing where they're doing sanctuary cities for the preborn. So what they do is they ban abortion in a city. Now, it's very symbolic. Most of these cities don't have abortion facilities at all. So it's a more of a symbolic thing. But there's a bunch of cities in Texas doing this right now. And primarily they're just going to try to make more lawsuits for the left to have to challenge. So they're going to do the heartbeat bills. They're going to say, you know, born alive abortion survivors can get protected. They're just going to keep challenging and being honestly just a pain in the butt to the left and just keep challenging them and pushing them. But also they do fight the culture front. I think live action is really good at it. Their videos have reached millions of people. And if you look at the comments, you see people's minds changing on abortion. Primarily, they have a video of abortion procedures to show exactly what happens in an abortion, which most people don't realize, especially if it's a surgical abortion. They don't realize that you rip off the head of a baby and then pull each part out. And then you put it back together on a tray to make sure that you got all the parts. Like, people don't realize how grotesque that is. And they don't realize that's what happened. They think, oh, vacuum. Oh, it's gone. No, that's not what happens for a lot of surgical abortions. So I think they are showing people. And then you also have the people doing, they call it counseling, sidewalk counseling outside abortion clinics. And I know they have a bad rep of shouting at people. And there are those people. But there are also a lot of people just there handing out bags with, you know, diapers and we'll give you support. I saw a video the other day, earlier this week, of a guy bringing his sister. Now, this is from August, but I just saw it. He was bringing his sister and her boyfriend to an abortion clinic. They're two 19-year-olds. And he didn't realize he was bringing her to an abortion clinic. She told him that she was just getting an ultrasound. But this is a surgical center for Planned Parenthood where they only perform abortions. And once the sidewalk counselor told him, like, hey, you're like, this is an abortion clinic, he went in and then he got his sister and they went to the pregnancy resource center across the street and got free resources, a free ultrasound, and she's keeping her baby and it'll be due later this summer. So, or not this summer, that'd be way too long. I think in March. So it's pretty exciting that you see some movement, but people who fight in the pro-life movement, they know that it is a hard battle. There's very bad days and most days are very bad. But it's also the one issue in the conservative movement that gives you inspiration, I would say. It's the one thing that, like, grounds you. So obviously, like we said, this week, it's insane. I'm, like, very over looking at the Capitol siege and all of this. But then you look at the pro-life movement and you're actually making a difference. That gives me hope.
Right. So one thing that's interesting is, there's this perception, I guess, that the next generation of young people, right, millennials and Gen Z, are super liberal and super leftist. And on some issues, there's more truth to that. But from the limited kind of data and polling I've seen, young people are actually, like, more pro-life than you would think, right? I mean, to what extent do you know what direction the kind of the movement is trending in with the next generation?
So they do call themselves the pro-life generation. I call myself part of the pro-life generation. Now, I think there are a lot of pro-life. I don't think we're losing any ground, but I don't necessarily think we're gaining any ground. I do think we're changing a lot of minds, and I hope to continue doing that through using TikTok. I make a lot of pro-life TikToks and get millions of views. I hope that continues to grab them. You know, they're all like 15 to 19 on TikTok. So you're grabbing them young and giving them some ideas that they wouldn't have gotten in school or any of that. So I have some hope for Gen Z, not a ton. I kind of identify as Gen Z when I'm feeling like it the day, because I'm on the line where I can be a millennial or Gen Z. But it's still going to be an uphill struggle, especially because now the leftist teaching that was in colleges is now reaching into primary school and, you know, elementary school and middle school. They have I don't know if you want to get into non-pro-life stuff, but they have like the 1619 project. So now people are getting the left pill a lot younger, and it's going to cause issues.
Yeah, I mean, the education system, especially the public education system, is kind of being co-opted by some of those things. But like you mentioned, the kind of internet age, right, whether it's like PragerU reaching millions of people or your live action millions of people on TikTok, it does give us a chance to reach young people with a different message, but it's hard when you're kind of locked out of the institutions and gatekept a little bit, because we're not going to get interviewed on a Snapchat show that's like, it gets millions of people, right? You're not going to get a pro-life activist on there. You're not going to get on like celebrities' Instagram lives, like they'll have the Planned Parenthood people on. So like to what extent is the pro-choice side of the aisle like winning on those fronts?
Well, first, we do have a risk. There is a risk that we'll get deplatformed. Especially, you know, we're posting pro-life stuff on TikTok. TikTok is run by China and they love abortion in China. They'll have forced abortion in China. So our days are numbered and we know that. So we're just doing as much as we can now, and then we might not be able to anymore, and it might have to be more of the grassroots thing. Now, the way that the abortion industry gets the young people is primarily through college campuses and adding in curriculum into high schools and middle schools. So I don't know if you remember your sex ed training. I got one in like fifth grade, and then I had another one mandatory in ninth grade. And, you know, they pushed abortion, all that stuff. Well, now they're trying to do it more. And they have Planned Parenthood teaming up with school districts. So they're pushing in, you know, from an institutional level into, you know, schools where your kids, I mean, I don't know, my mom had to sign a permission slip allowing me into it, but you know, maybe that won't be a thing. They'll just say, okay, every student's doing this, whether your parents want you to or not, which can happen in public schools. So they're pushing it at an institutional level, but also they have celebrities, you know, saying donate to Planned Parenthood. Oh, look, abortion's so cool. Like, I'm a celebrity. So they have Hollywood helping them. Mm-hmm. They have tech helping them. They have everyone helping them. So it's really a grassroots thing that the pro-life movement's really going to have to own, because, like I said, our days are numbered on social media, but social media has been very effective for us so far, especially pushing something that a lot of the abortion industry likes to push back on, which is the abortion reversal pill. So if you do take an abortion pill, there is a pill to reverse it. If you take it within, I think, 24 to 48 hours, and the abortion industry tries to claim that, you know, it's fake, it doesn't really work, it's a lie, they're giving you propaganda. No, it works. There are children alive today that have been saved by the abortion reversal pill, and that's something that they are trying to hide.
Wow, that's interesting. I've never heard of that. And I'm someone who's plugged into even conservative, and wow, I've never even heard that that was a thing.
It absolutely is. There's a hotline and everything.
So we've mentioned Planned Parenthood a couple times. This is a really interesting one, because a lot of people have a very favorable view of Planned Parenthood that actually know nothing about it. So one thing I remember, and I think you'll relate to this with your Mount Holyoke background, I took for kind of to troll a little bit, but also just to push my own boundaries. Senior year at UMass, I took a gender studies course.
I did too, with
a very leftist professor, and everyone there was like very leftist and social justice oriented. And during some conversation about abortion and Planned Parenthood, I just brought up the fact that the founder of Planned Parenthood was a eugenicist who wanted to wipe out the black race. And nobody except the professor knew that. And she was like, yeah, that is true. And we have to talk about that. And there's intersectional elements at play here. And I'm like, obviously, not to get into that too much, but like, none of them knew that.
Well, now they know this. A lot of people know this now because of the Planned Parenthood in New York City. You know, during the Black Lives Matter riots, they were trying to get rid of racism. And so they, a lot of them called out the institutional racism at Planned Parenthood with one of the heads of the clinic. And then also they talked about Margaret Sanger. And I think they tried renaming some things too. So I think they're now being awoken to it. But for a while, they were claiming that we were lying, we were conspiracy theories, we're saying this about her, but they have lots of primary sources documenting that. And I'm glad that your gender studies professor actually stuck up for that and didn't call you a liar, because that happens. And good for you for talking in gender studies. I took gender studies my freshman year, so I didn't know what I was going into. I actually thought that we were going to talk about the struggles of women. I thought we were going to talk about the Middle East and talk about, you know, some other issues of women. I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking. I was a freshman. And then I walked into it and it was not about women at all. It was about race and transgenderism and intersectionality. I don't know. It was a very weird class. They talked about cats quite a bit. There's a lot of debates and fights, and it was intense.
Debates about cats?
Yeah, they debate a little bit about cats. But I remember this one time, one person stood up and said, I think transgender people are very interesting. So that's all this person said. And then another person said, how dare you say that? We're not freaks. We're not interesting. We're people. And the original person who said trans people are interesting said, well, I'm trans too. And then they started fighting about who was more trans. And I just remember I looked down. I was just doodling on my notepad like, oh my God, this is really intense. I'm a freshman. I don't want to be in a class where people are yelling at each other. So that was my gender studies experience.
Well, I remember when I was in that class, we were talking about Title IX, the law that mandates. Well, not in the sexual assault context, in the sports context of college sports. And I pointed out, I just simply said, I think it is true that there are biological advantages in sport that don't go away when there's a when a person transitions and is transgender, even if they take hormones. And there was just like stunned silence. And the professor was like, guys, and I actually respect this professor. I mock her a little bit, but actually I do respect her, because what she said was, the point of this class is to have tough conversations. And it's like, it's crazy that it's a tough conversation, but she basically did make people have the debate and the conversation, which is what a professor should do. So I mock her a little bit, but I do give her credit. But the room, it was like stunned silence. Like, you would have thought that I said something horrific. All these, and I was like one of the only men in the class, and I was one of the only, it was maybe half and half people who would be say they are trans or non-conform, gender non-conforming or non-binary, and then people who are not. And it was like a bomb went off. It was just stunned silence. And I was like, I know
exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because classrooms are very quiet. And so when someone says something that's a little different and there's a silence, that silence lasts forever. Everyone's looking around. You can hear like people like itching themselves, you know, writing something. It's yeah, I've definitely been in that situation.
Yeah, I was also in that to talk about abortion. I mean, I took a constitutional law class and a civil liberties class where we would read up on Supreme Court cases and debate them. And I remember being literally like the only one in the class who was like arguing that Roe v. Wade as a decision does not make sense based on the case study that we read. Because it's not actually based on anything that's in the Constitution. It's yeah. based on like a penumbra of rights suggested and implied and all sorts of kind of legal nonsense that isn't my expertise, but you alluded to it earlier. And it was like, again, it was like stunned silence. So it's like, at the very least, I introduced some people to a new argument. But I guess to wrap it up, we can move to a slightly more lighter subject. Like I ask every guest that comes on the show, what is your, and you have many, I'll just go out there and say you have many, Cassie, but what is your hot food take you want to lay on the audience today?
Okay, I'm only saying this one because I had it for dinner last night, but I have a lot, like you said. So for dinner last night, I made a blackberry pie, and then I made sirloin steak, and Parmesan potato wedges. And then also, not for me, because I think they're gross, I made candied bacon Brussels sprouts. Brussels sprouts are disgusting. Anyone who eats them, like, I'm judging you. I had one last night, and I'm like, why'd I even eat that? That's gross. I'm not really a vegetable person, but I know.
All
eat, like,
green
beans
healthy.
And broccoli. I eat, like, green beans and broccoli and, like, that's and carrots, and, like, that's it.
Those are actually my three favorite vegetables. So that's, like, 90% of what I eat. And salad.
Yeah, like I'll eat salad if it has really good dressing, like the hibachi ginger dressing. If it doesn't have that, I probably
won't. I hate that dressing. I like balsamic.
Oh, you don't like the hibachi? What?
I hate it.
I've never.
Whenever I get hibachi, I don't eat the salad. I give it to someone else.
Well, you're pathetic because it's really good. But yeah, Brussels sprouts are gross, and if you eat them, I'm judging you.
Okay, that's a hot take there, so that qualifies. And with that, we will wrap it up. So everybody, thanks for tuning in, and Cassie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.